April 15th, the Ides of April. Welcome to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. April 15th. Oh my goodness, this month is flying by.
You hadn't done one of those in a while.
I know.
Thank you for breaking that back out.
So today, we're talking designer babies. Would you use science to choose your baby's traits? Advances in embryo screening now allows parents to test for more than just deadly diseases. Companies are offering risk scores for everything from heart disease and schizophrenia to height, eye color, and even IQ. And support for this technology is growing, but so are the questions. Is this empowering science or eugenics in a new outfit? Is this about preventing suffering, or are we curating perfection? So today we're going to explore polygenic embryo screening, what it is, how it works, and what it could mean for the future of reproduction. Lots of ethical questions are swirling in my head, and we'll explore them. We have a journalist who has done some deep dive research on this topic. We have a bioethicist on our panel, as well as a local mom who used this screening process for herself. And our question for you at home and those of you on YouTube who are listening and watching this, the question is, do you think genetic screening is a good idea? And where would you draw the line? Would it be diseases? Would you be okay with height, eye color, all those things? We want to hear from you. The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube, be sure to drop your question or comment in the chat.
Love a good ethical debate.
And, I do too.
I really look forward to this show because it is a fascinating topic. But before we get to all of that, Cherry, we want to go through a trio of local news stories, as we often do. Yep. And we would be remiss if we did not at least mention the staggering and scary news over the weekend out of Harrisburg. A man named Cody Balmer, age 38, allegedly scaled an iron security fence, eluded police, and set fire to the Pennsylvania governor's mansion while the governor, Josh Shapiro, and his family were inside. Governor Shapiro and his family were uninjured. You likely know that at this point. Balmer is in custody. There are a lot of unanswered questions in this case, but we want to play a clip of Governor Shapiro speaking on Monday after this incident over the weekend.
This kind of violence is becoming far too common in our society. And I don't give a damn if it's coming from one particular side or the other, directed at one particular party or another, or one particular person or another. It is not okay.
An understandably emotional Governor Shapiro speaking to the press after that attack on the governor's mansion. And this man, Cody Balmer, has already told police, reportedly, that he intended to do physical harm to the governor.
Yeah, pretty scary. I just want to say, first of all, I'm really glad that no one was hurt physically in this incident, regardless of your political affiliation or how you feel about the governor, or he is a civil servant. And I mean, that's a scary, scary incident. And what stood out to me in this is, you know, we have seen violence against people in positions of power, elected officials. And so it just sort of stands out to me. I can't really talk about the differences between each incident, but it just seems like it's getting more common to me. We've heard judges getting threatened. There was an assassination attempt in Butler, Pennsylvania against now President Donald Trump. We had the CEO of United Healthcare murdered, you know, by someone. And it just feels very like it's very scary, tense times right now.
Lots of tension also around the global economy, and it's impacting a local business significantly and directly. And that's story number two, Cherry.
Yeah. Philadelphia-based Five Below has put a pause on all new orders from China due to significantly increased U.S. tariffs that have more than doubled the cost of new inventory. Now, if you have never been to a Five Below.
Oh, who's never been to a Five Below?
Some people might not. I'll explain. But they're known for selling cheap
sunglasses. Go while they still exist.
LED watches. They have all kinds of knickknacks if it's around the holidays. And most of their materials the products that they sell are imported from China. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they've been hit hard by this 145% tariff that's been imposed on Chinese goods by the Trump administration. And according to reporting, this would be a tax of $1.45 for every dollar the item is worth. So you think about if you're buying stuff for $5 and it's $1.45 tax on every dollar, that significantly increases the expense. And this is an 1800 store chain based in Center City. And they basically said importing products from China is prohibitively expensive right now. Five Below basically instructed, you know, the return of all shipping containers shipped from China since April 10th. And now they're working on strategies to mitigate the tariff impact.
First of all, I don't know if people know Five Below is based here in Philadelphia.
I did not know that. Yeah. But there's a Five Below that just opened near where I live like 3 weeks ago.
I haven't been into a Five Below in a long time. But this is an interesting kind of Rorschach test for how you interpret these tariffs, right? Because this is like the the very easy way to understand the impact, right? A business like Five Below, they import all of these cheap baubles from abroad. And obviously those are going to be tariffed and it's going to be harder to get those things. But of course, a lot of people look at those things and say, I don't really need that stuff. And that's how they then sort of interpret the impact of the tariffs. Then there's, I feel like there's this hidden side of it that the Five Below part kind of masks, which is that lots of components and materials are imported from China or are routed through China in some way. And impacts on the costs of those things are going to show up in a fragmentary way in other types of products, right? And so the Five Below thing, I think, cuts to how a lot of people sort of initially are interpreting the impact of the tariffs. I wonder if over time people will see this sort of other side of it that's a little further down the supply chain.
Yeah. I've been reading stories about, you know, business owners in the United States who bring in a lot of their products from China. Yeah. A lot of them say that, you know, they can't afford to manufacture their product here. So they have manufacturers overseas and it's impacting their American companies.
Yeah.
But that's where they bring their product in. And for many of them, it's cost prohibitive to import those products now.
By the way, Five Below, did you know when it was founded? I was surprised by this.
Oh, no. Let me know.
Well, what would you guess?
Probably like 10 years ago.
Oh, I thought it was like a long, long time ago.
No,
It's not. 2002. So
yeah.
Further than 10 years ago. But I thought for some reason in my mind, Five Below was like some sort of legacy company.
No.
Maybe I'm thinking of something else. I have no idea.
Yeah.
Okay. So third story.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of things that cost way more than what you'd find at Five Below, a hotel here in Philadelphia just got a major endorsement, Sherry. Are you excited about this?
I am excited. This one made me laugh. Go ahead.
Former Real Housewives star, current entrepreneur, social media influencer, and generally amusing human being, Bethany Frankel recently stayed at a hotel in Center City and was impressed to the point of confusion. Let's take a listen to her hotel review on Instagram.
I just got back from Philadelphia, stayed at the nicest hotel, maybe in the world. It's crazy. Like maybe in Morocco or certain parts of Asia that are nicer, but none in this country. None. Four Seasons in Philadelphia. With all due to Philadelphia. Like, nicest hotel in the world.
That clip there has gone viral.
Yeah.
Now, Frankel did not say what she likes about the Four Seasons in Philadelphia, but clearly she was blown away. My initial reaction, Cherry, was to be offended that she was so surprised
that
the nicest hotel in America would be in Philadelphia. But then I thought about it and I said, I'm a little surprised too, to be frank.
Have you ever been there?
To the Four Seasons?
The new one, the Comcast Center, yeah.
I've heard of it, but no, I've not. There's restaurants there that I haven't been to. Obviously, I've not stayed there because why would I do that?
Yeah.
But have you been there?
I've never stayed there, but I will say it's pretty nice. You walk into the building and there's this beautiful aroma that greets you. Yeah, it's like...
What?
It's like you walk in and there's smells that are very like enticing.
Well, most hotels have
a
smell.
And then the lobby is just beautiful. They have these flowers. And then you go into the elevator, which is all glass, and you get to see the view of the city. And then you go into the lobby, which is gorgeous, and there's a restaurant with a bar, and there's always like attractive people sitting there.
Why are you hanging out at the Four Seasons?
Well, I met friends who came into town, and they were like frou-frou, and they wanted to meet there.
You've got Four Seasons friends. I got it.
But I'm just saying, sure. it is a nice hotel, and that I haven't even stayed in the room. So
by the way, I did look it up. Rooms start at about $1,200 a
night. Whoa, that needs to be
nice. Reasonable rates. You know, you go to the Red Roof and the Four Seasons, it's about the same. It comes out in the end. You only live once, folks. So we're going to transition now to our main topic for today, which is not hotels or influencers or anything of the sort. Cherry, tell us about it.
Yes, our main topic is the reproductive technology, IVF. Has helped millions of couples become parents since the very first embryo transfer in the 1970s. And while fertility treatment has advanced rapidly in the past several decades, genetic screening is nothing new. About half of patients using IVF today will choose to screen their embryos for abnormalities like missing or extra chromosomes.
What is now emerging, thanks to advances in gene sequencing, is much more sophisticated and detailed genetic profiling. In a recent three-part series for the New York Times, journalist Anna Louise Sussman digs into how private companies are using new technology to offer IVF parents an incredible amount of information on embryos before they're implanted. Patients can look at the risks for health conditions like heart disease and certain cancers, and they can find out characteristics like eye color, IQ, and even height.
And in her series, The Embryo Question, Sussman writes about, quote, the cluster of cells at the crossroads of science, ethics, and the law. And she joins us now via Zoom to explain some of this new technology and the ethical questions that it poses. Anna Louise Sussman, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you. Before we get sort of off into the future and we zoom out into what may be possible, I am curious if you can answer for our audience what most people are using genetic screening for today. Like the average couple who's having a child through IVF and is doing some sort of genetic screening, what are they typically screening for?
Absolutely. There's two, I think, forms of genetic screening that are the most common. One is if you know that there's a family history of a certain disease and you want to learn more about whether that's going to be passed on to your child, you can screen the embryos to see if any of them are also carriers, either of one copy or from both parents, so that you can try to pick an embryo that's not going to carry that disease. The other one is for just chromosomal abnormalities. So the ability for a pregnancy to continue is often based on whether the embryos are chromosomally normal or not. So a lot of people do what's called PGTA screening for aneuploidy, which means there's some sort of mutation or there's parts of the chromosome missing, and those kinds of things typically mean you're going to have miscarriage or pregnancy loss. There's some debate as to whether PGTA is actually useful, and the fertility sector, their sort of professional body, the ASRM, did just release an opinion saying it's not actually conclusive, but it is something that doctors might often recommend if you've had, for example, repeated implantation failure or repeated pregnancy loss to patients, to find out information.
Just to clarify that second part, that's for fertility. I mean, that is to increase the chances of a successful pregnancy, right?
You want to bring home a baby. That's the main metric that fertility doctors use is live birth.
And so let's talk about this more recent technology that's typically offered by private companies, polygenic screening. Can you explain what that is and how that takes the typical type of genetic testing up a notch?
Absolutely. So what we were talking about earlier, if you want to know more about whether there's a disease that's going to be passed on, those are usually what are called monogenic disorders, meaning the variant is located on a single gene. So I think we mentioned cystic fibrosis. Down syndrome is another one that a lot of people are familiar with. And that you just run a test and the gene sequencing can tell you, okay, it's there or it's not there. Polygenic screening is based on advances in what's called genome-wide sequencing. That's the ability that you can do this now because of just how much more data we're capable of analyzing, and also how much more we know about the human genome. You can analyze the whole human genome and say, okay, a trait that's much more complex than something located in a single gene, so something like diabetes or heart disease or certain kinds of cancer, it's many, many, could be tens, hundreds of thousands of genes that may contribute to that condition. And we're going to look through the genome and say, okay, if you have X number of these, it's associated with having a higher likelihood of having a condition. But it's essentially a probability. It's not affirmation or verification of the presence or absence of a gene. It's saying you've got, you know, more of the genes that contribute to, say, being being predisposed to cancer or diabetes, or you have fewer, or this embryo has fewer of them.
Mm. So Cherry mentioned that private companies are offering these services. Mm-hmm. And of course, that raises a bit of a red flag for me, because I wonder, first, do we have any transparency around these companies' claims? In other words, are they full of you know what?
So that's a good question. The science is TBD because it's relatively recent. Yeah. And this, along with a lot of fertility medicine, I think should be clear, it's really hard to do randomized control trials. And technologies, this is all sorts of technologies in fertility medicine, often reach the market before they're really rigorously evaluated. It's also, I mean, this is human reproduction. And so in general, there's a lot of ethical concerns around, you know, setting up one set of babies with this or one set of patients with that, denying the treatment to the others. It does happen, but it's much harder to do. And in general, I've heard from a lot of fertility doctors that patients are just, and from patients themselves, I should add, that they often want to try something, even if the evidence is not there, because they're desperate for a baby. But that's, as we were saying earlier, that's with when you're trying to just get a baby. What these screenings claim to offer is the ability to select a healthy baby. That's the actual tagline of one of the companies, excuse me, have healthy babies. So it flashes across their website when you go on their website. And whether or not they can actually do that is, I think it's still up for debate, because the genetic component of any condition is just one small factor right. in what will ultimately lead to someone developing that condition or not.
Because environment is part of that. I have to ask you, what are they basing this data on? Because I'm assuming that you you have to have some money, like some serious money, in order to be able to even access this level of screening. So who is there, like, data? Who is involved in this data set? Just to get a real understanding of, if you're making these claims, like, what are you basing that on?
So the work is typically done using, there's two really large data sets. These are biological samples that have been collected since about the mid 2000s. One is in the UK and it's called the UK Biobank. Another one is in the US. And unfortunately, the data as it stands is largely based on people who are Caucasian or European descent. So any information you glean from analyses of these huge databases of biological information and genetic information is going to be mostly applicable to, again, people with that kind of ancestry. So it has limited application for people who aren't descended from Europeans, and that definitely makes it of limited use and limits the sort of populations that can access it. You also mentioned the cost. It's $3,000 to $5,000 to do genetics. IVF can be between $15,000 and $20,000 in the US. So there's definitely a very high barrier to entry. You know, if you believe this information is useful and accurate and you want it, you also face a very steep financial cost.
One more question, real quick, as we get ready to wrap up. The laws around this in the U.S. seem very, very minimal. Is that right?
Yeah, as far as I'm aware, there are no laws against it. So it's really left for a patient to navigate and to make sense of the information they're being given by the companies, As far as I know, companies require you to have some genetic counseling, but there's also, a lot of ethical questions that I think are not really addressed. For example, are you setting up a expectation of what kind of child you're going to have? What happens if the child is not what you expect? I think it takes you into a realm of you're not just working with what you've got, you're trying to take it a step further because of the different kinds of qualities and things, not just medical conditions, but things like height or educational attainment or other things that people believe they can offer the screening for in the future.
Yeah, and I think you're a mom. You did not use this screening for your daughter, even though you used IVF. As we wrap up, just your thought, the big question you think this leaves for parents making these decisions.
I was reading a quote from Elon Musk's daughter. They're now estranged. She's trans, and she had written on social media that her gender was a commodity. She believes her father selected for her to be a boy, and then when she didn't demonstrate the trait that he selected, he became really angry, and they're now estranged. And so I feel like we need to think about what it means to pick the baby you want to have rather than just receiving your child as a gift and wanting that parent-child relationship versus a very specific kind of child.
Well, that sets us up perfectly for our next segment. We're going to dive into the ethics of all of this. But first, let me thank you, Anna Louise Sussman, a journalist who most recently published a three-part series called The Embryo Question in the New York Times. Thank you again for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And coming up, we do have a bioethicist joining us to talk about all of the thorny questions. We want to hear from you. Studio2@whyy.org or 888-477-9499. And welcome back, everybody, to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. If you're just joining us, we're talking about advances in gene sequencing that offer IVF patients a vast amount of data on their embryos. Parents can screen for a host of genetic diseases and even physical traits like IQ, height, eye color. It sounds like something out of a science fiction movie. Remember the classic 90s film Gattaca?
I've taken the liberty of eradicating any potentially prejudicial conditions. Premature baldness, myopia, alcoholism and addictive susceptibility, propensity for violence, obesity, etc.
We didn't want, diseases, yes, but...
Right, we were just wondering if it's good to just leave a few things to chance.
You want to give your child the best possible start. Believe me, we have enough imperfection built in already.
Now, recently, a Harvard survey found that most respondents approve of embryo screening, but this expansive and largely unregulated technology raises some significant ethical questions. Could the desire to have a healthy baby devolve into having too much information? Is there a line to be drawn before we head down a slippery slope toward eugenics? Joining us for the rest of the hour via Zoom is Art Kaplan, professor of bioethics at NYU's Grossman School of Medicine. He's been writing extensively on genetics and reproductive technology for almost 4 decades. Sorry to age you there, Art. Art Kaplan, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and our question of the day for you at home, our listeners, and those watching on YouTube is this. Do you think genetic screening is a good idea? Where would you draw the line? The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube, be sure to leave your comment in the chat.
Lots of comments already, yeah. Including one from Joe in Pensauken, who says, renaming it does not make it any less like the eugenics movements of the early 20th century, which quickly degenerated into overt racism, especially in the current white supremacist culture we find ourselves living in. That's Joe's take. Art, what is your take? What do you see as the major ethical questions raised by this technology?
Well, first, Avi, you have to understand this area has had no legislation, no oversight, and no regulation since it began with the birth of Louise Brown way back in 1979.
Yep.
And I'll age myself by saying I wrote the first article on the ethics of IVF then, and call for some determination of who could use the techniques, what for, and so on. But because this has been, Anna Louise said, reproduction, legislators don't like to get near it. They don't want to talk about embryos. They don't want to get into restricting or trying to control parenting. They don't want to raise the specter of abortion. So the first big problem is there's no oversight of what's taking place here. There's nobody regulating anything. Could I try to make a perfect baby tomorrow if I was Elon Musk and said, look, all I'm interested in is creating a computer genius? Sure, I could do that. And as long as I found willing helpers, doctors, and so on, and if I had the money, I could do it. Second, there's no agreement on what we ought to be screening for. People generally are more comfortable with diseases. And I think, Avi, you pointed that out, and sure, you may have noticed that in the Gattaca film. Mm-hmm. But here's a question. I'm going to throw a trade at you.
Sure.
Albinism, the genetic condition where people don't have skin pigment.
Yeah.
It's not a big issue in white America. It's a big issue in other countries. If you have an albino kid, it's considered a major disease. And in some societies, you kill the albino baby, it's considered cursed.
Wow.
We don't have consensus yet. And what are we looking for? I mean, it's if you're congenitally deaf.
But how would you,
some people say,
we could go down this rabbit hole for a while. The question is, where do you start as an ethicist? Because as you point out, a lot of this is relative to the culture you're being raised in or brought into as a child. And then there's all of these quote unquote diseases. Some people might call them disabilities. That some people would look at the exact same thing and say, that's not a disability, that's not a disease.
Yeah,
so we know, I think we kind of understand why there isn't a lot of legislation here. The question is, if we were to try to legislate it, you know, where would we try to attack this thing?
So let me give you a couple of areas. First, it might be nice to set up some notion of liability and malpractice. Mm-hmm. You say you're going to do X and you don't do X. You say you're going to give a baby that doesn't have a disease, or you're going to produce a child that has better than average athletic performance, and you don't do it. Who's responsible? Who's made the error? Can you hold anybody to account, or can any company just go online, as I fear they're doing, and make all kinds of promises that they're not held accountable to, and they just take money? Secondly, what about mandatory counseling about these diseases? Let's hear the perspectives of people who are deaf. Let's hear from people who have, I don't know, autism. Let's hear from people who say, this is what it's like, and you should hear this before you decide that you want to do screening. I think counseling ought to be mandatory. It ought to be defined as broad-based before you get to try these technologies. Access, or I'll ask you both the question. Is there a right to have a child? Well, you might say, yeah, there is a right, because we shouldn't restrict what people do in the bedroom, although there are efforts underway to do that. But there's no entitlement. If I need a surrogate mother, if I need IVF, these procedures are not paid for or covered.
Right.
Should they be? Do we need fair access? So Trump, by the way, started out as saying he was the IVF president. I don't know if either of you ever heard him say that. And then he immediately decided, well, maybe we're not going to pay for this under Medicaid.
Right.
The first time I hear a congressman say, we got to give poor people the right to have more babies, will be the first time I hear somebody say, we got to give poor people the right to have more babies using IVF and genetic screening. It's a rich person's game right now. That's not fair. You might start down those roads. Yeah. Last issue. Mm-hmm. If I say I'm a 90-year-old man and I want to have a baby, and I want it to be a better baby because I don't have a biological heir, I won't be alive to see it, but, you know, that's what I want. Any restrictions on eligibility whatsoever?
Hmm.
Yeah. And that sort of is my question right here, because we've talked about how there's no regulatory framework here in the United States. So what are the risks of just letting the market lead this? Because if it's all about money, it raises a lot of red flags, because you could have 90-year-olds, you could have anyone sort of doing this and leaving the children just here. So can you
Believe
talk about
not,
some of the dangers? Yeah.
There was a case in Pennsylvania a long time ago a person who'd been convicted of child molestation, signed up and used a surrogate mother and a donor egg to have a kid. So there are certainly some places we might want to say, like we do with adoption, maybe you get a little examination of your home situation. Are you abusive? Can you afford to raise a baby? That sort of thing. So that would be another area I think we could make some progress in. But let me flip it, Cherry, and answer you this way. I think when you leave it to the market, which is what we've been doing, you have all manner of practitioners, honest people who really try to help people have kids, honestly try to help them avoid diseases they know are running in their family that are primarily genetic. And then you have every private equity investor out there who says, freeze your eggs, make a better baby, go for perfection, way before the science is there. And that's my opinion of where we are now. The science, even with polygenic abilities, to start to screen for many different risk factors. It's not great science yet, but the market is pushing it because many people want to use it.
Yeah, the snake oil risk. Let me read this comment from Will in Westchester, who says, to a very large degree, we already select our children's genetic traits when we make the choice of who to procreate with. I mean, that's fascinating, right? Because a lot of people, maybe consciously, maybe subconsciously, pick their partners based on their partner's genetic traits. He's really smart.
Or at least what they look like.
Funny. I hear this all the time.
Yeah.
And it's true. But you know what we do? We disguise our genetic traits. That's what makeup and dresses and maybe other, say, cosmetic and plastic surgery type things.
Sure.
You look at what we do, we're trying to fool one another. You can't just go well, with the physical
without going
appearance.
Too far down the road of dating and what dating is like. I guess, what do you see ethically as the difference between someone who's maybe an athlete at college saying, I would really like to marry another athlete and have an athletic kid, versus someone doing a similar thing, but through, you know, pre-implantation genetic testing, like testing for athletic prowess. Like, honestly, what is the real difference between those two things?
Well, again, let's go to where the science is. In the same family of two great athletes, do they always produce great athletes?
No.
No. Depends on the environment.
But they wouldn't necessarily do that for the genetic screening either. It would just be a probability.
No, they don't. Yeah. But what I'm saying is, before you set out to say, I'm going to produce a quarterback, as some parents have tried to do, in creating NFL-style athletes, be aware that that's not how genetics or environment works.
Sure.
You have no guarantees. You can increase the odds, and to some extent, genetic screening does that too. No guarantees. When you go to if you need an egg donor and you want to have a baby, but for some reason you can't make eggs, you're too old, or you had your ovaries removed due to a medical procedure, they give you a book, and that book lists all kinds of traits of women. One thing I noticed is the demand for and the price of eggs is very much related to the college that these women are at. If you want to rank colleges,
absolutely,
Princeton eggs are worth a lot more than community college eggs. Now, is that square with the science? Not necessarily, but it shows.
But here's my question.
You bring a lot of biases
but
to
my,
bear.
My question for you, Art, is like, I think most people, because we're getting comments, right? A lot of people are saying, I'm not comfortable with the idea of screening for a trait like athleticism in sort of pre-implantation genetic testing. But I think those same people would not say, I would restrict athletes from marrying other athletes. There seems to be this kind of diversion of public opinion based on how you frame it, whether it's with science or with sort of a more quote-unquote natural approach to driving toward these desired genetic traits.
Well, it's true. And part of it is just practical. There's not much we're going to do about restricting
who
people decide to
do and what they do. That's a little different from saying, I'm going to use public money to fund efforts to do genetic screening and IVF for people who want to do it. And let me add this again. I just want to say it. The future of the field is not infertility treatment. It is making better babies. That's where the business model is going. Whether we can do it accurately today, it's definitely something that I think we have to recognize. There are a lot more people who might want to make a better baby, even if they're fertile. And there are infertile people who want to use this. So it's a serious policy question. How does this society or any society want to make its kids? Another technology out there just to freak out the listeners completely.
Yeah.
We have an artificial womb in development. That is, you all know that abortion has traditionally been limited under Roe up to 22, 23 weeks. Why? Because the lungs aren't there for the fetus and it can't breathe, can't survive. If you build an artificial womb, you can take reproduction all the way back and have it meet IVF and start to make screened embryos in better, quote unquote, environments. Who would want to make them in a woman's womb? Who knows what the heck is going on there?
Yeah.
We'll make them in nice artificial wombs with the right nutrition, the right oxygen. The future could be, and I'm going to go further, probably will be to some extent, the scientific creation of better babies.
Mm. Wow. Wow. We have Lou from Hatfield who says, any honest parent will say that they'd make a few adjustments. Mm. And so we only have a minute and a half or so in this segment before we go to the break. But I want to ask you, can you quickly tell us what some other countries have done? Because, you know, U.S., we've left it open, but other countries have given this some thought.
Well, take a country like Singapore, which wants smart people for its small society that is very dependent on, if you will, intelligence. They give incentives to the parents they think are smart to have more kids. That's the model that Avi was using. They're not doing genetic screening yet, but I bet they do. Other societies, Holland and the UK, have some restrictions on who's eligible. But in general, Cherry, I don't think anybody's gotten up to the plate yet and done what should be done, which is to say, here's the list of diseases, screen for those. Here's the list of perfectionist stuff. We're not sure yet.
We're not sure yet. By the way, I should note that Beans47 on YouTube calls you, Art Kaplan, the goat of bioethics. That means greatest of all time, by the way, if you didn't know that. It's not an insult. So stay tuned here on Studio 2. On the other side of this break, we're going to talk to a local mom who has used some of these pre-implantation genetic screening technologies.
Yes.
For her own kids.
And we would love to hear from you. Do you think genetic screening is a good idea? Where would you draw the line? The number is 888-477-9499. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. And for those of you watching on YouTube, leave those comments in the chat and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
My name is Avi Wolfman-Arendt, and right now we will continue our conversation about major advances in genetic screening and the ethical concerns they pose. Our question for the audience today, do you think genetic screening is a good idea? Where would you draw the line? Call 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org, or if you're on YouTube, drop your comment in the chat.
And we've been talking with NYU bioethicist Art Kaplan. And now we want to bring in a parent who has used the type of polygenic screening we've been discussing. We have Simone Collins, a mom of four, working on baby number five, and a writer and an activist. Simone Collins, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you. Hi.
And you got a cute little one right with you this afternoon. So I want to ask you, you and your husband, Simone, have used polygenic screening. Can you share with us why you decided to go this route?
Yeah, our first preference was to determine birth order of our embryos because we plan on having a really large family and we have a lot of embryos. But my mother died very young of cancer, and I want to be able to give a couple extra years to our kids with higher cancer risks, because at this time, 2 or 3 years could mean the difference between life and death. And I don't want to doom our children to the same fate my mother faced.
Yeah, I read that for your daughter specifically, you wanted to make sure that you had low stress children, given the size of the family that you wanted. That trait kind of falls outside of what normal people, I won't say normal people, but what many people would screen for. And it goes into other types of traits. So why go for low stress and outside just, you know, disease and things that we've seen used in by larger populations of people?
I could ask you why you would choose a non-psycho partner. I mean, when you choose the person you reproduce with, you're selecting for traits. But yeah, absolutely. When we look at things beyond just cancer risk, because you can see a lot of things, anything from gum disease to infertility, there are even polygenic scores for earning potential, though those don't show up with the embryo companies that we work with and individuals. So when we look at additional traits that we think are important to try to address, for which we don't think there are current cures yet, we look at a lot of mental performance adjacent traits like depression, brain fog, inability to deal with stress. There are many people who suffer from these things who really don't have a good cure right now. And there are lots of people now who even wouldn't have kids if they felt like their risk of depression was really high. So one reason why we love the fact that some parents can look at things like depression for children is that it would mean the difference between them having children or not having children at all.
So, do you have your own ethical line around this? Something that you don't want to screen for? Or for you, is it just sort of, open season? Like, I want to know all the information possible, and I want to make my pick with all of the information I can possibly get from company X, Y, or Z.
We're nerds about this, so the more we know, the better. But plenty of people have come up to us and said, "Hey, I have a disabled kid. I just hate the idea that you are a proponent of this technology that will cause people to weed my children out of the gene pool." My response to that is always, "Well, yeah, and guess what? I'm autistic, and we could theoretically screen our children for autism and not have kids with higher risks of autism. We don't do that because we don't mind autism as a trait. We think it may have some advantages in the future, so we don't screen for that." The most important ethical line that we have actually has to do with coercion. We really hate the idea of people having their reproductive choice and options limited. And we think it's really evil for people either to be forced to use technology like this or to be forced not to use technology like this. People should have the freedom to form the families they want to have in the way they feel is best for them.
Can I switch back over to Art Kaplan now on that point? Because, we have seen a lot of people in the comments bring up the specter of eugenics and the eugenics movement. But I think one potential distinction here is we're talking about the choice to use this on an individual level as opposed to a society-level prescription for a sort of eugenical program. Is that a major distinction to you, Art Kaplan? And do you think ultimately we should lean in the direction of individual choice?
It is a big difference, and I've tried to point out the difference between Nazi eugenics is forced, coerced, genetic engineering by death, murder, sterilization, restrictions on marriage. And then what Simone is talking about is individual choice to do improvement. You can label it as positive eugenics if you want, but the key difference is a respect for individual choice. And I respect that difference, and I think it's morally obvious that we're not, I don't think anybody, occasionally you get somebody who resurrects murderous eugenics, but that's for a different time and a different political discussion given today's events. What I would say is this: I think we should move down this path slowly. Clearly, there are disease states that everybody agrees is a disease state. And I'm not even talking about autism. I'm talking about death early at the age of two from some terrible genetic condition. It's very hard to say you shouldn't be allowed to not use screening for that. When you get to the perfectionism or the improvement, individual choice is important. However, here's where I would add something to Simone's point. I think you need to have counseling and full information. I like those conversations with people who have kids with disabilities. Remember, I brought up my albinism example. There are four albinos that won the Nobel Prize. It may not matter much to people that you're an albino, but it may be a fact that you want to point out to someone. I'll give you one other example. In situations where mixed race couples are going to use a donor egg, they overwhelmingly choose white donors because they see being black as detrimental to the kids' prospects. Do they need some conversation about that? Would it be important to say, well, you choose based on your bias, your culture? So, building in my field, informed consent, it means informed, not just preference, taste, bigotry.
And Simone, I guess my question, was there any counseling here? I know you and your husband are nerds about this. You mentioned that. And so you've done a lot of work for this, but I just wonder, was there any type of counseling there? And would you recommend that for other people who may not be as knowledgeable about this and wanted to use such services?
Yeah, I think counseling is a great idea and a very good thing for couples to get, especially because polygenic risk score selection, what we're doing is only about risks. It's not about guarantees. Now, obviously, there are some genes that can pretty much guarantee a really terrible medical condition. But what we're talking about with polygenic scores is mostly just, hey, relative to a population that also is very broadly based off of Europeans' genetics. So if you're East Asian or something else, it may not be as predictive. You know, you need to be coached through these things. And I think it's really important. I would want to add one point to Art's note that it wouldn't be necessarily bad to stop all families from having certain kids with really terrible crippling diseases that make them die at age two. I think that's tragic. I wouldn't want to do that to a child. But I will point out that there are some religions that believe destroying any embryo for any reason whatsoever, not carrying it to term and bringing it to as long of a life as it can have, is morally wrong. And again, I really believe that people should have the freedom to make whatever choice they think is morally right, even if that makes us very uncomfortable.
Just jumping in there, you may have a situation where they're asking the rest of us to pay for that choice. So again, when one is making individual choices, okay, you pay the freight, you carry the cost. It's a very different thing to say you're in the ICU for 2 years with an inevitable death charged to a health system that's overwhelmed.
Right. And then that the ethical considerations are sprawling in a society where we all share the risk burden and the cost, which is, you know, this is the society we live in, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And Simone, I wanted to ask you one more question. Just how do you have these conversations with your children? Do you tell them that they were part of this screening? Do you not tell them? Does it even matter whether or not they know?
It 100% matters. And even for our kids who don't have this kind of screening, because not all of them do, we will, when they're old enough, get them fully genomically sequenced. Why does this matter? Well, one of the most common scores that you get on these polygenic risk scores for embryos, but you can also get this for yourself as an adult or for a child, are polygenic risks for things like schizophrenia. Why does this matter? Well, if you tell one kid, hey, avoid cannabis, drugs are bad, they're going to think that you're just being a square parent. If you tell your kid, hey, listen, you're personal genetic polygenetic risk for developing schizophrenia is higher than the average for the population, and high doses of cannabis can trigger schizophrenia. So while it's fine that your friend Jimmy has as much like cannabis vapes as he wants, you really shouldn't, because you could go crazy. It's really good to tell people that. So yes, we tell them that they're screened. We tell them what their risks are, because in some cases, we're going to want them to get screened for certain cancers really young. In other cases, we want them to avoid certain foods or risk factors. So this stuff is really valuable, not just in terms of choosing birth order or embryos.
Yeah. So you see it as a form of empowerment and knowledge. Really interesting.
Absolutely.
Art, let me ask you one more question as we start to wrap up. I do wonder a little bit, like, this is all fascinating conversation when we talk about where this technology is headed. But when we started this conversation, I noted, we noted that for the most part, this is used to screen for, like, you know, disease factors with a single genetic input. It's not used in this polygenic way, or it's used for fertility reasons. Is this conversation a bit of a red herring to be talking about this, to be highlighting this, when a lot of people just want access to the use that is the most common? Because I do think some people worry that we're demonizing this technology a bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's a fair point. I think we do have a public policy question in front of us. Should we or should we not cover infertility services for all? That depends on your answer to the question, is there a right to have a child? And I think there is. And I think it's an important aspect of life if you choose and want to do that. So that is today's problem. Tomorrow's quickly going to emerge, however, because while I'm not convinced yet that the science is strong for a lot of the polygenic, we have polygenic screening here at NYU, and I know our geneticist folks very well. As Simone pointed out, you know, it's kind of a risk. You're getting a little bit of information, but we're not really that great at predicting complex behavioral and mental traits. We just aren't. But we will be. We'll get better. And the time to discuss how to apply that is now. You don't want to do it in the middle of a gigantic corporate marketing scheme to say everybody ought to buy this and create two classes of people, the people who can do fancy improvement, the people who can't. And you don't want to wind up either making sure you've got to have a safety net for people who don't choose it. Disability won't go away. Mm. There still will be outcomes that are poor. You got to protect the rights of those people too.
Any closing thoughts for you, Simone, as we wrap up this conversation? We have about 30, 40 seconds.
I think the most important thing for people to think about, because as much as Art said, it's really uncommon for people to connect this with Nazi genetic campaigns and stuff and eugenics. This happens all the time. I'm accused of being a Nazi almost every single day online. Hmm. And I think people have really mistaken understanding of what's going on. I'm selecting birth order for my embryos. I think this tech is cool and people should be allowed to choose who they marry, who they have kids with, who their sperm or egg donor is, all of these things. And we just promote freedom. I just want to point out that shaming people or coercing people into choosing things they don't want to choose for their own kids is kind of, that's the evil thing. That's the baddie thing.
Well, that is Simone Collins, local mom of four. Thank you so much for your time today on Studio 2, Simone. And thanks to you, Art Kaplan, NYU bioethicist. And as Beans47 said, the goat of bioethics. There he is, Art Kaplan. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Yes, and thank you to everybody who emailed in and commented for our question of the day. And thanks to our producers, Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Thanks to Mike Schiffler, our visual producer, and Al Banks and Tina Calique, engineer today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philly, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolf-Manera. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll talk to you tomorrow.